Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
National leader Judith Collins is accusing the government of playing politics by not immediately backing Chris Liddell to head the OECD. The New Zealand businessman turned Donald Trump advisor was nominated for the job by the United States. But Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says Cabinet hasn't made a final decision on who it'll support.
Number of things that we want to take into account. And what I would say is that we have a wide range of considerations. Citizenship is not the only one.
Ms Collins told RNZ political reporter Yvette McCullough, backing Mr Liddell should be a no-brainer, and she's questioning whether his affiliation to President Trump is the reason for the government's indecision.
I would have thought that it is always going to be in New Zealand's best interest to have a highly qualified, very experienced person like Chris Liddell heading the OECD, and it's far more beneficial to New Zealand than playing politics on it. Certainly, I noticed that when we were in government, National was last time, is that we supported Helen Clark to both head the UNDP and also the United Nations, but we also supported before that, in the previous National government, Mike Moore to take on the World Trade Organization role. There are certain things governments need to do. One of them is to back New Zealanders. And I would have thought it's a no-brainer for the government to do the right thing, back Chris Liddell, unless they've got some other New Zealander who they think's got a better chance.
And so do you suspect it is political and that it is his affiliation with Donald Trump that's part of the issue?
I suspect that the media need to ask her that because I can't think of any other reason.
The Prime Minister said that it's more than just citizenship that's being considered, but do you think that him being a citizen is something that should weigh heavily in the decision of who to support?
Well, clearly, if she's suggesting that there's something wrong with him in terms of his qualifications, his experience, then she should front up on it. The fact is that Chris Liddell is a highly experienced, very well-respected person in business circles, but also, obviously, not only in New Zealand but in the US. If the Prime Minister's got something she wants to say about Mr Liddell, she should front up with it.
That's Judith Collins speaking with RNZ Yvette McCullough. A new report has revealed the dire state of thousands of children on the waiting list for serious dental work. It shows thousands of children are there waiting 8 months or more in pain, and the list is growing faster than the city's public dental service can clear it. There are not enough resources to keep up. The report also found many children will miss out on their routine appointments this year, with COVID-19 adding to the delays. The president of the Dental Association, Katie Ayres, told RNZ's health correspondent Rowan Quinn she knew there were problems but was surprised by the enormity.
We know that the children that are waiting for treatment under general anaesthetic have significant dental needs. That's why they're on the waiting list. So we know they have active tooth decay, they may very well be experiencing toothache or infection. And so along with that goes difficulty eating, difficulty sleeping. You know, if the child's not sleeping, the parent's probably not sleeping either. So it can really affect the happiness of the household and really the development and learning of the child.
What do you think about the fact that there's a couple of thousand kids who could be waiting up to 8 months to be seen and that that list is just growing?
Yeah, well, I think the reality is they're going to be waiting more than 8 months, because if you're adding 50 children onto the list every week, then there's nothing for it but the list has to keep growing, unless there's more potential to outsource or find more theatre capacity to enable the service to treat those children.
And there's also big delays in some of this care that could prevent kids getting to this stage. You know, barely any under twos are being seen, and barely any of them are getting that fluoride coating on their teeth that can help. You know, what is the significance of that?
Well, I think the reason for that is because post-COVID, the service has quite appropriately prioritised the children most in need. So it's kind of the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff has had to pick up a bigger role, meaning that there's been less potential to do the preventive measures. So those children that are under two, hopefully most of them have actually got quite good oral health, but there will be a number of them that that are starting to develop significant levels of dental disease as well.
And what about the year rates? You know, the kids in their last year of intermediate, the last year that they're sort of seen in the public dental service. They're giving up about 70% of them aren't going to be seen at all this year. What impact does that have?
Well, this was quite concerning, and I was surprised to see that only 24% of Year 8 children have been treated. Those children are going to be released into the adolescent dental system with unmet dental need, and that's concerning, obviously, for the children that haven't had the treatment they require, but also for the next oral health practitioner who's going to be looking after them, who's going to potentially be seeing a lot of those children needing treatment as soon as they enter the practice.
How was it looking in other DHBs? Are there any others that would be struggling on this level?
I think that there will be several DHBs with, you know, real severe problems. I think some of the smaller DHBs find it easier to find the children and get them seen, but this is not just an Auckland problem.
That is paediatric dentist Katie Ayres there speaking with RNZ's Rowan Quinn. The UK and the European Union are back at the Brexit negotiating table. They're resuming trade talks in Brussels this week, and it comes after they failed to resolve issues last week, the thorniest being fishing and ensuring fair competition. But the clock is ticking. It's less than 7 weeks to go before the end of the 11-month Brexit transition period. Let's cross to the UK and to our correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, kia ora, 7 weeks to go. Is there going to be a deal or no deal?
Good morning, Susie, and everybody else. Well, that's an easy one to answer, and that is I have absolutely no idea. See, unlike trying to commentate, I don't know, on a football match or a cricket match or a rugby match, it's incredibly tricky to know. But I guess what I'd say is this, that there are plenty of economic and diplomatic reasons for them to do a deal. Why economic? Well, obviously, the pandemic has caused mayhem here in the UK, but in Europe as well. Do they really want any further economic disruption from a no deal? Diplomatic reasons for doing it. We now know that the US President-elect Joe Biden thinks that Brexit is a really dumb idea and he doesn't want no deal. And of course, the UK and the EU don't want to sort of get off on the wrong foot in the post-Brexit era. But, of course, the real problem is politics. And I'll be brief, but I mean, essentially, it's the same as it was since the referendum in 2016, Susie, and that is it depends on the extent to which the UK prioritises sovereignty above all else, and the extent to which the EU sticks to the position that, look, you know, the UK can't have as good or a better deal outside the EU than in it.
Does this mean that the situation with Ireland, the border, whether the border is going to be down the Irish Sea or the actual land border, is that still unresolved and thorny as well as things like fishing?
Absolutely. I mean, that is exactly it. And you know, it was always going to be the case that if the UK decided to leave the customs union and the single market, those are the, you know, if you like, the main economic bits of the European Union, you were going to have a border. Suddenly there was going to be a border between the UK and the European Union. And that meant there were, you could either have a border on the island of Ireland. Well, that's difficult because of the history of violence in there, and it could be a target. Or you would have to have the border between Britain and Northern Ireland, and that's kind of precisely where we are. It was something, of course, that the Remain side in the campaign warned about all along, but nobody took it too seriously.
Is there any chance that with so little time left, and considering that everyone at the table or every government at the table is having to deal with a surge in coronavirus cases, any chance of an extension?
I guess there is. I mean, they may not call it that just because it would be so humiliating for the UK. But, look, Susie, I would rule nothing out in this. It's certainly true that I think both sides would prefer to have it resolved before this transition ends on the 31st of December. But, I mean, if they don't, could it be called something else? Could things spill over? Could it all go on? You betcha.
While you're here, Rob, if I could ask you a couple of things about Boris Johnson. He's now back in lockdown, I understand, because he could have been exposed to coronavirus for a second time.
That's right. You know, Boris Johnson is one of those people where, I guess until recently, you just described him as one of those amazingly lucky politicians, right? Someone who, no matter how many gaffes he comes up with, no matter how many mistakes, people seem to like him, partly because of his personality, a bit of fun. But it's as if his political luck has run out with the absolutely kind of catastrophic shenanigans of his members of his senior team going and now being told to lock down again. I mean, you just could not make it up from being the luckiest politician in the world, Boris Johnson, now seems like his luck has run out.
Tell us a little bit about those, as you call them, shenanigans. Dominic Cummings, also Lee Kane resigning. Take us inside how that all played out. The notice period, which was going to be a month, I think, suddenly becoming immediate. He went within the hour. What's the fallout?
So, you know, I shouldn't have called it shenanigans because that makes it seem sort of funny and silly, and it isn't. It is just immensely serious, Susie. How do I begin to describe this? So I guess to put it in some context, you need to see this in the broader scope of it. It's just part of the rolling political crisis that Britain has been in since the referendum in 2016. I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that. Where does this latest bit fit in? Well, the two guys who resigned, one of them I think perhaps people in New Zealand will have heard of, a guy called Dominic Cummings, these were the people who were the brains behind Vote Leave's success in the 2016 referendum, which Boris Johnson led. They were also behind Boris Johnson's success in winning the general election in December, which led him into Downing Street. So these two men have now gone. So that, you know, that is big stuff. I mean, Dominic Cummings has been described as Boris Johnson's brain, and I make two other brief points about it. The first thing is, all of this drama tells you, doesn't it, that, you know, when Britain was supposed to be dealing with this, the worst health crisis in 100 years, you know, there was chaos and dysfunction at the heart of government. The second point is, there are a lot of people in Britain saying, ah, yes, this is a chance for Boris Johnson to reset his government and to perhaps lead a government that's been a bit less divisive and a bit, you know, a bit less prickly. I mean, I'm sceptical about that. I mean, I think there may be some change in tone, but essentially this remains a pro-Brexit government, and whether or not there is going to be a deal with the EU or not, it's going to be a dramatic change in Britain's domestic and foreign policy leaving the European Union. And I think that Mr. Johnson, you know, will be judged on whether ultimately whether Brexit is a success, whether the pandemic is brought under control, and essentially his leadership. Because just one final thing, you know, a lot of people say, the problems that Mr. Johnson has been having is because of these rather abrasive advisers around him. Well, now that they've gone, we'll find out whether they were the problem or whether maybe Mr. Johnson was part of the problem too.
Thank you very much, Rob Watson there, our correspondent in London.
Now, the announcements come as the United States surpasses 11 million cases and nears 250,000 deaths. On Friday, it reported about two cases of COVID-19 every second, for a total of over 180,000 cases that day. The US death rate is consistently over 1,000 a day for the first time since August, and hospitalizations have reached their highest point in the pandemic. As a result, states are reimposing restrictions that haven't been in force since the first wave of the pandemic swept the country months ago. Among them, North Dakota, Ohio, New Mexico, Washington, Illinois, Utah, Oregon, and the latest, Michigan. High schools and universities there have gone back to remote learning, and indoor dining has been suspended. Michigan's governor is Gretchen Whitmer.
As the weather gets colder and people spend more time indoors, this virus will spread. This is the worst public health emergency our nation has faced in over a century. And our response has got to reflect the same level of urgency.
However, the White House disagrees with the measures. Dr. Scott Atlas, the radiologist whom President Trump looks to for advice on infectious diseases, has urged the people of Michigan to rise up against the new public health measures. Let's go to our US correspondent Simon Marks to talk about all of this. Simon, kia ora, good morning. Let's talk about the vaccine first. Sounding incredibly promising, having a second vaccine coming available within a week. When might it actually be on stream?
Well, Moderna, Susie, says that they're going to have 20 million doses of the vaccine ready to ship in the United States by the end of this year. So the Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar has been talking over the course of the last few hours here about the prospect of getting those vaccines into people before the end of this year, with plans, of course, for another 100 million doses of vaccine to come during the course of 2021. We will still be looking at it taking many, many months for this vaccine to end up being received by Americans in very large numbers. But there are two substantial differences between the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine that was unveiled a week ago. One being, as you heard there, this Moderna vaccine can be stored for up to 30 days in a standard home or medical refrigerator. It doesn't require all sorts of extraordinarily complex deep freeze equipment to maintain it. Also, this Moderna vaccine has been developed in part with US government money. Operation Warp Speed, the president's initiative to try and kickstart vaccine development, invested $955 million in the Moderna project. It did not invest money in the Pfizer project, and so I think you can expect the Trump administration, at least for the next 65 days, vigorously to try and get Moderna to deliver as much of this vaccine as possible before the president leaves office.
Speaking of the president, the situation with the lack of concession and the lack of transition, kind of bringing the US to the edge with the pandemic, and it's now fragmenting the approach around the country.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York threatening to take legal action against the Trump administration for the plans that they have to use private medical companies to distribute this vaccine. Governor Cuomo says that that leaves minority populations disadvantaged because, for the most part, they don't use private medical companies for their health care. They rely on publicly provided facilities. The numbers, as you heard from Corin, are through the roof. We had more than 1 million new cases of infection here in just 6 days alone. More than 1,100 Americans a day are dying of COVID-19. And from the President of the United States, no recognition of that fact. 2 hours ago, he tweeted, "European countries are sadly getting clobbered by the China virus. The fake news does not like reporting this." He has evinced absolutely no recognition of the spiraling infection rates that the country is recording from coast to coast, nor has he authorized his Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar to begin communications with the Biden team about the rollout of vaccines, which is leaving Joe Biden up in Wilmington, Delaware, to have to begin now devising his own plan for vaccine distribution, because the Trump team won't even talk to him about the transition, because they don't recognise currently the transition's going to occur.
Simon Marks, our US correspondent, thank you very much.
Joined by the COVID-19 Response Minister, Chris Hipkins. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning.
If we could start with vaccines and the encouraging news of a second vaccine, Moderna. Can you confirm that New Zealand has some rights to this particular vaccine, like we do with the BioNTech?
There's about 230 vaccine candidates under development at the moment, and of course we're monitoring them all, and we're in conversation with as many of them as we can be. I'm not in a position, to go through each and every one of those 230 vaccine candidates, because there's different degrees of commercial sensitivity around those. We do announce agreements when we reach them, and when they've signed on the dotted line, we do announce those. But we're in good conversation. New Zealand will certainly be getting them.
Okay. Is there also the benefit that if Moderna comes on board, that relieves some of the demand potentially for the BioNTech, which we have announced that we have quite a lot of, or getting a reasonable amount of? Can you then upscale and get more of the BioNTech one?
Look, our strategy here is that we're looking at a portfolio of vaccines, so there won't be a single vaccine for New Zealand. It's likely that we'll have a number of different vaccines coming into New Zealand, probably on different timetables, bearing in mind that we're preparing to be able to distribute those, given that some of them will require different technology. So the Pfizer vaccine requires a very, very low temperature, minus about 80 degrees, in order to store it and to transport it, whereas this latest one, you're talking at a more regular vaccine temperature for storage and for transport. So we're making sure that we've got the trucks and the refrigerators and all the gear ready to go for all of the different potential vaccines, so that at such time as they start arriving, we can start getting them out there as quickly.
Well, that's interesting. So can you tell us what, in terms of the BioNTech one, which is what you have to be negative 80 degrees, what infrastructure do we actually have in the country to enable you to effectively roll that out right out to all your GPs right across the country?
So we're in the process of procuring gear. We've got some gear, but we will need new trucks and new refrigerators in order to make that possible, and that's what the team are working on at the moment. So
what sort of a budget are we talking about for that?
Oh, whatever we need to, basically. So, you know, we're making sure that we're investing in that stuff now so that when at such time as we need to hit the go button on it, the gear's there, it's ready, and we're ready to distribute
it. To what extent? So, you know, do you have to have a fridge that can go that cold? How would you do it? Would it actually be out to your GPs, or would you have centres? How many of these sort of fridges would you need?
Ultimately, it will depend on what the vaccine, how long the vaccine can be stored at different temperatures. So what we know about the Pfizer vaccine is that for the longer term storage, it needs to be stored at a very, very low temperature. But some of the vaccine candidates can be stored at a slightly higher temperature for a short period of time. So it might be that, you know, you get your vaccines delivered daily to the GP practices, and then they can be stored at a higher temperature whilst they're being administered. So all of the logistics of that are being worked through, bearing in mind that for some of these vaccines that information is not yet final. So that's part of the R&D process is locking all of that down.
Let's go to masks. Can you explain to the taxi industry and those taxi drivers why you aren't making it mandatory in the taxis in Auckland?
So we did look at taxis. There's a variety of factors that come into play around taxis, one of which is enforcement becomes a potential issue. Now, I heard a taxi driver on your show just before saying if someone gets into my cab and says that they're not going to wear a mask, the only choice I have is to tell them that I'm not going to carry them and lose their business or carry them without a mask.
Yes, but it's psychological, isn't it? I mean, if you put an enforcement order, people will react to that. That's how you're hoping everyone, it's peer pressure. It's that if it's mandatory, people will get into the habit. So at least you'll get most people complying getting into taxis.
One of the things that we also factored in the decision there was the degree of distance. So you're in a much smaller group of people. The taxi driver themselves will be wearing a mask. That's mandatory. Most people, when they sit in a taxi, sit in the back seat, which means they're distanced from the driver. So the taxis can still do the things that we ask the businesses to do. You know, maintaining good hygiene in their cab is actually one of the best things they can do to protect themselves and protect their passengers.
What changed with this decision? What was the advice, the medical advice that you received that made you change this decision?
Look, it's something that we've had under constant review. The last time we considered this was back around Labor weekend, where the advice at the time from public health officials was that we should introduce masking at level one on a temporary basis. One of the things that Cabinet was very mindful of when we considered that was not having the rules changing all of the time. We do want to have some stability and predictability in the rules, and that's one of the reasons why.
Well, why didn't you just leave it in force after the last time you had it in?
Well, at the moment, the public health advice was not to do that. It was at the time, it was to reduce the mask usage. But then also, the advice here is shifting all of the time. The decision the Cabinet has made yesterday is actually slightly ahead of public health advice. So the public health advice was, again, to introduce masking on a temporary basis while we're investigating this current group of cases that we're dealing with.
But we know that the epidemiologists and the WHO, since about June, if you go back to about June, there was quite a bit of debate earlier in the year, but about June it was when the WHO advice changed. A number of the likes of Michael Baker and others started saying, you know, masks make sense. Even the cloth masks work on public transport. Why has New Zealand been such a late adopter to this?
Yeah, so look, we weigh up a variety of different factors in this, including the degree of public goodwill to the measure, towards those measures, the likelihood of compliance. We look very closely at that. So all of those things, you know, weigh up. Some of the countries that we can get compared with have much more authoritarian regimes than New Zealand. So if you look at Taiwan, they've got a much greater degree of compliance, but they're much more authoritarian approach to the way they're doing their COVID-19 response than here in New Zealand. We've been very successful because New Zealanders have all bought into the response that we have, and we've had a high degree of compliance when we've asked people to do things.
Could I just ask you quickly about the COVID card or the Tracer app? I've seen some reports that you're looking at including Google and Apple software within the app that would Bluetooth track contacts or COVID-19, if you came into contact with someone on COVID-19. Is that progressing?
Yep, so we've got the COVID card trial underway at the moment. That's due to wrap up in the next few days, and we should have the results of that within the next week or two. So that's the first piece in the puzzle that will be very useful. We are looking at the technology that we could incorporate within the app. One of the key things for us is concerns around privacy and making sure that we're protecting people's privacy. So the COVID Tracer app at the moment works on the basis that you own your own data, and the government doesn't pull that data away from you. You own it. You get to control what happens with it. So anything we did in that GPS, Bluetooth technology space, we would be working on the same principle that any information that your phone or any device you had, you were collecting was your
And looking
data.
At the Google, Apple technology, from what I've read, it doesn't necessarily track your location. There is a privacy element there that they're looking after. It just notes if you've been in the vicinity of someone with COVID-19 and pings in on your Bluetooth. So that would make sense. Is that something you are involved with Apple and Google on?
Yes, we are looking at that. But I do want to say here there's no silver bullet because, of course, that technology relies on other people having the same technology as well. And you'll come into contact with a lot of people who aren't carrying a phone or who aren't carrying a card, and therefore we're going to need to have ways of tracking that as well if we're in the position of having to contact Trace for you because you test positive for COVID.
When could that be up and running, that Apple-Google element to the COVID app?
Look, I'm not in a position to put a time frame on that at the moment, but I can say that, it's something that we're actively investigating.
Minister, thank you very much for your time. COVID-19 Minister Chris Hipkins.
A dioxin alert has put a Waikato grandmother off having her grandchildren or pregnant daughter-in-law over to visit. Months after an underground fire started in a landfill near Pukemiro and Glen Afton, west of Huntly, authorities advised pregnant and breastfeeding women to temporarily shift away. The Waikato Regional Council says it's a precaution based on a preliminary health assessment while it waits for specialist equipment to arrive to do testing. Dump owner John Campbell refused to talk about the dioxin alert to RNZ. Last week, he ridiculed locals' health fears. Jean Ree of Pukemiro got the dioxin notice at the weekend.
I was godsmacked, actually. I just thought that, wow, really? Cars all over our villages on Saturday, ringing us on a Sunday to find out if we've received the letters. How can one person do this to these towns?
She got the notice and you've had your pregnant daughter
here. I've had my daughter-in-law here that was pregnant. Well, she came to announce that they were having a baby. The next day she was sick. I'm hoping it's got nothing to do with that. After receiving that letter on Saturday, it made me question whether it was that.
Are you going to be able to see her?
No, she can't come here, no way. Because of the contaminants, because we never know what we're going to smell. The air, it's shocking. It's just absolutely shocking. I can't believe one man is doing this to about 400 or 500 people.
Mr Campbell on Friday, he said that this was all sort of hysteria and made up.
He's calling a few of us activists. I'm definitely not an activist. I would definitely rather be sitting at home or be in my garden than out going to meetings to hear or listening or being on Facebook, seeing what people's fears are.
Well, tell us about your other grandchildren. What's the story with them, the older ones?
Oh, I've got two grandchildren that live in the township as well. I've got a 10-year-old and a coming up 12-year-old. Children that go to Glen Massey School, and they get up in the morning and they've smelt it. They've just about been sick on their way to school, and they get up and ask their mum, is it smelly today?
Are they going to stay in the town?
At this stage, yes, because they've got commitments. They've got animals, they've got school, jobs. I don't know anybody that could just up and leave their home.
And you've also got other grandchildren who don't live there, who you won't be encouraging to come and see you?
No, I don't want any of them here. I don't even want my grown daughter here or my other grown son here without their children. I don't want anybody coming to visit me. I've put off my cousin coming this week. They were coming from Huntly to visit me to have a look around my gardens, and I've put them off as well. It's basically taken over my life, to be honest.
That's Jean Ree of Pukemiro speaking with RNZ reporter Phil Pennington.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.